Let's roll this thing. Roll that beautiful bean footage. Hello, and welcome to the award-winning Ardent Atheist, where reason reigns supreme, not frogs and fish. Today's episode brought to you by billions of years of evolution. Sitting next to me is my co-host and producer, Heather Henderson.
Hi, everybody.
You know Heather from the Facebooks, on the inner tubes, and our other hit podcast, Skeptically Yours. You can find links to our guests' website, join our Twitter and Facebook feeds, subscribe to our premium ad-free 90-minute full-length episodes, and our email at ardentatheist.com.
If you'd like to take part in a live chat moderated by the author of the well-known blog, Hit and Miss, Joe Swam, go to ardentatheist.com/live and chat us up right now.
That's right. Hey, is it my turn?
Yes.
Okay, and please go to iTunes, subscribe to our podcast for free, and write a review. Help us get in the top 10. You may also go to ardentatheist.com/premium and subscribe to our premium ad-free content for a measly $10 per year.
Subscribe now because the Bible says so.
The Bible doesn't say that.
Sure it does.
Where in the Bible does it say that people should subscribe to our show?
It's in there.
Have you ever read the Bible?
No.
And how can you say that?
Because lots of people talk about the Bible who haven't read it.
I see what you're doing.
Yep, now go subscribe. We only have two rules on the show. Rule number one, guests may plug anything they want. We're not hypocrites. Go subscribe.
And rule number two, if you're a listener who's ever been offended by anything, get a sledgehammer and destroy your computer now. This show has no restrictions on language or content, and certainly has nothing for you, you 6,000-year creationist jagoff. We're coming to you live from E&H Studios in sunny Studio City, California. In the Studio City tonight, we have Christopher Ryan and Ed Clint. You know these guys from Showbiz. I don't know if you know Ed Clint from Showbiz. That's not
and the
really
world
true.
Of not reason. So
usually we have Showbiz types on, Clint.
Oh, sorry.
All right, Ed. Thanks for being here. Christopher Ryan, thank you for being here.
My pleasure.
I'm reading the fuck out of your book.
Read the fuck out of that,
reading
baby.
The fuck out of that book. I'm halfway through.
I'm watching him read it.
I'm an insane.
I actually did download it to my iPhone and started reading it.
Is he getting wood while he reads it?
Oh yeah.
Well, he's always got.
Yeah.
Wood,
when do I not have wood, Chris? That's the question. Yeah, it's fantastic. I really am enjoying it. I posted on Facebook that I was reading it, and I was talking to my Facebook friends about it, and then Ed jumped in and said, "You really probably should check out this link." And there are some evolutionary anthropologists. Is that what you call them?
Evolutionary psychologists.
Psychologists, right? That particular flavor of the study that kind of take exception, I guess, with some of the things in the book. And so I went and read that, which actually made it for a more interesting read. I got to be honest.
You're talking about the Ryan Ellsworth critique?
Yes, that's exactly it. Yeah. And so before we jump up to that, tell us about the book. First of all, I love the idea that our relation to bonobos suggests that we might be more fitted for a poly lifestyle. That appeals to me.
Of course it does.
Yeah, of course it does.
I wonder why.
Do a little introduction, or
what do you mean?
Do people already know who we are?
Well, yeah, let's do that. Obviously,
whose show is this?
I presume
anyway?
Everybody. Yeah, thank you so much. Christopher Ryan is the author of Sex at Dawn. Is the book that we're talking about, and I could outline it, but I think you would do it better.
Well, I mean, maybe the best way to get into it is to talk about how I got into this whole world of reasoning. I initially read a book called The Moral Animal when it first came out in 94 or something by Robert Wright. Fantastic book. And that book really outlines the sort of fundamental assumptions of evolutionary psychology, which is that men have forever traded things like protection, meat, shelter, status, all that kind of stuff.
Seashells.
Well, I got a good story about wampum for you.
Okay.
We can come back to that later. Yeah, that's a crazy story. But anyway, it's a very economic sort of relationship between men and women, where men have always traded these goods and services to women in exchange for fidelity. And the reason that was so important is that the men wanted to know that they were only investing in their own genetic legacy and that they weren't raising some other guy's kids and blah, 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 right? So everyone knows that reasoning, which is at the heart of evolutionary psychology. I loved it. I thought it was fantastic. It made sense. That's why women are cautious. That's why men want to fuck everything that moves. It explains everything, right? At the time, I was living with a woman who was a stripper, and she had a lot in San Francisco, and she had lots of very outspoken, smart, feminist friends. And so when I laid this stuff on them, they were all like, dude, No, that's a male's vision of the way things are. That's not how we really, that's how we're forced to be by a society that's misogynistic and paternalistic and all that. And I was also working for an organization called Women in Community Service, where everyone there was like 50 women, one other guy and me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was surrounded by smart, outspoken women. And every time I laid this argument on them, they just shot me down. So I went back and started looking at the underlying research.
Well, we need to talk about how to pick up chicks, because you don't lay these arguments to get laid. They're not going to work.
Well, that's another story. Yeah, there are lots of different ways to go with that one. I mean, I think one of the best ways to meet women is to eliminate the ones who you're not going to be successful with early.
That's nice.
You know,
eliminate. What does that mean?
Well, like,
just don't hang out with them.
Be honest.
Take care of them.
Be honest.
Oh, okay.
Like, lay your shit out on the table early, so people who aren't into that can say, "Yeah, I'm not into that," and they're out of the picture, and then you go on with women who are into that, or guys, or whatever.
Right.
Anyway, but that's another story. So the point is, I started looking into the underlying research, and that's when I discovered bonobos. Wright doesn't really talk much about bonobos in the book. He talks a lot about chimpanzees, a lot about swans and prairie voles and all sorts of other examples, but he doesn't talk about bonobos much. So I discovered bonobos, and it's like, wait a minute, bonobos?
And let me tell you something. I've mentioned bonobos to probably half a dozen, a dozen or more people, and half the time the response is, what's a bonobo?
Right.
That's the weirdest part.
Get out.
Well,
here.
And the people who know about them only learned about them within the last decade,
right.
For sure.
Because we've only learned about them in the last decade, really. I mean, we thought of them
mainstream.
As pygmy chimps.
Right.
Right?
Right. Franz Duval is really responsible for bringing bonobos into public consciousness. And anyway, so I'm looking into that. Then I start looking into the anthropology, and I start finding lots of societies that completely dispute this understanding of male-female dynamic and that it's in our genes and yada, yada, yada. And so I felt like I was pulling a thread on a tapestry, and the more I pulled, the whole thing just started to fall apart.
Right.
So that's how I got into it. So I'm very familiar with the evolutionary psychology arguments. I anticipate those critiques,
sure. And
I understand where they're coming from, because if Casilda and I are right in our argument, a lot of the foundational assumptions of evolutionary psychology are wrong. So it's going to be a dispute anytime we talk about it.
Right. You've met with some people, like the critique we were talking about. And Ed, had you read the book at all?
I have not read
okay.
the book. I've read a little bit of it, and I've read some of the reviews and responses. But
yeah. And I presume that you're leaning toward the other way. You think that Chris's book is getting some things wrong. Is that right?
I couldn't say that definitively.
Right, right.
Not having read it. I've read some of it. It's kind of breathless and intemperate in its prose, I would say. That's.
Thank you.
And based on what I know of you and what you've said, I think we would probably disagree on a good variety of points. So that's fair to say. Yeah.
Well, can we talk about some of those points? I mean,
sure.
You know them. You've written them. Let's get down to brass tacks on this. This show will not be that comedic. We're really going to delve into this book. That's one of the things I want to make sure we spend time doing. What are some of the things that you're saying in the book that are really being challenged heavily, Chris?
Well, I mean, first off, I'd have to say that there's not as much academic critique of the book as I was hoping
expecting, frankly.
You know, I
think it's interesting you say that, since there's a book-length reply written by an academic.
Self-published, and it's not an academic, and we don't even know who actually wrote it because it's written under a false name, which I find
name.
Is very strange.
You're talking about Sex at Dusk?
Yeah. By Lynn Saxon, who didn't exist anywhere, has no trace on the internet until this came out. And my mother gets phone calls in the middle of the night telling her she should be ashamed to have given birth to me.
No way!
Oh, yeah, there's
all sorts of
bizarre shit going on. Both the publisher of Sex at Dawn and the publisher I'm writing the next book for have received phone calls from people who refuse to give their names saying I've plagiarized sections of the book, no specifics, accusing me of planning to plagiarize the book I haven't even written yet. And there's some strange stuff going on.
Do you have a title for it yet, even?
Oh, sure. Civilized to Death.
Ah.
Oh. Civilized to Death. Okay.
Yeah. I think it's original. But anyway, so, I mean, I'm happy to talk about critiques, but there aren't as many critiques or as strong critiques as I would like, honestly, or from you know, the kind of people. I was hoping Steven Pinker would have some things to say, but so far he's avoided that. So Ryan Ellsworth, which I guess is the main critique that
that's the one I read.
People are talking about, I think he's written two now, and I think he's a grad student. I'm not really sure who he is or where he is. And it's been a year or two since I read it, so better for you to raise the points and I can respond to them because I don't have them memorized.
All right. Well, I'm going to look it up, and we'll pull that up, and we'll go through a couple of the points specifically.
Okay.
The broad thing that I took away from his critique of your book was that he felt like, first of all, there was some ad hominem in it, which pissed me off. That just, I mean, challenging scientific ideas, in my opinion, should not require that you be completely top to bottom studied in a particular field. That's just bullshit, in my opinion. And the ideas that you talk about, the differences between the chimps and the bonobos, and the comparisons that we have been raised to understand are perfect examples of how we ended up how we are. Those comparisons that you're challenging are impressive to me. I'm a lay guy, I'll admit, absolutely. But I'm quite impressed by your arguments.
Thanks. I think, have you heard of David Barish?
No.
He wrote The Myth of Monogamy with his wife, Judy Lipton, I think her name was.
Right.
And it's interesting, he wrote a critique of the book, which was actually a review, I guess, of Sex at Dawn. It was published in the Chronicle of Higher Education, I think.
Right.
And it begins by saying, if one more person asks me about this book, Sex at Dawn, I'm going to puke. That's the first line of this academic, you know, review.
Right.
And then people can find this review online. It's not behind a paywall or anything. And it's interesting because he goes through and he accuses us of fabricating evidence, of misrepresenting science, of cherry picking, of not knowing, I'm quoting here, not knowing the first thing about how evolution works. You know, just everything you could possibly throw at us.
Yeah.
But you know how many examples of any of that he's given?
Well, that's how I felt.
None.
That's how I felt when I read the critique. What's the author of the critique?
Ellsworth.
Ellsworth. When I read Ellsworth's, it just seemed like it went after ideas without support, much like Ken Ham's fucking arguments. It was really bothering me. It certainly didn't make me feel like what I was about to read was fallacious or bullshit. You know, it made me
want to go and read it. And
it made me want to read it more.
See what they were talking about.
And it also made me feel like someone was just defending their life's work as a, you know what I mean?
Well, and fair enough. I mean, look, if you've spent even a few years in grad school or certainly your life's work, articulating an argument, and then somebody comes along and says, you know, the fundamental assumptions in that argument are flawed, it's completely natural to respond to that aggressively and to feel threatened by it, and I don't blame anyone for any of that. I just wish that if people are going to accuse us of dishonesty, as Lynn Saxon, whoever that is, has, I wish, first of all, they'd use their real names.
Right.
And I wish that they would give examples, because I'm certainly willing to say that I could be completely wrong. I don't claim to be the ultimate authority in any of this. And making this sort of argument is multidisciplinary, right? So, you know, I spent about a decade studying primatology, studying anthropology, studying psychology, human anatomy, you know, because all this stuff comes together in this argument. And, you know, I've got a PhD in psychology, but not in primatology
sciences,
and all these other things.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm certainly open to have a conversation. I don't think this is the answer to everything, but I do think that we've articulated a strong argument, and I'm willing to talk about it. But let's not call me a liar at the beginning, right?
Yeah,
or an idiot or whatever David Barish did there. So having said that, you know, not to be defensive or anything, but the book also has won several awards. It won the award from the American Association of Sex Therapists and Researchers. It won the Quad S Award. So it's also received a lot of support from academic and clinical
communities. Yeah, I found out about you from Marty Klein.
Oh, right.
And, and I mean, he's an active sex therapist.
Yeah.
And it certainly connected with him and his experiences and his understanding of the processes. Were you going to say something?
Well, maybe I can try to speak to the other side of this. So, and I can't in a fully knowledgeable way because I'm not familiar with all the claims that you're making. But there are many people for whom this is their life work, and it is very difficult work, and they do it for years. And somebody comes along who they interpret or they perceive to be naive, unfounded in their claims, biased, and not especially skillful. But speaking to them as an expert and demanding a reply, they're not going to be inclined to render a reply to you because you're not entitled to one from their point of view. It's very much, in my opinion, like this recent business with, I don't mean to compare you unduly, but just in terms of the perspectives involved, Bill Nye versus Ken Ham. A lot of people say that you should not dignify Ken Ham with this platform where you're putting him literally on the same level with somebody who knows about science and evolution. Well, that's debatable in that case, too. But That's I think what you're up against. It's why you didn't get a lot of criticism back, and it's not the case, I think, that not being properly credentialed, however you want to say it, is the problem here, right? The reason that it matters asking where people were educated or trained is not because it's important to appeal to authority, but because it's important not to. Okay, so it's not about authority, it's about reputation. Reputation is important and powerful, and it should be. I want to go to the guy that everybody says is the best at it, right?
Yeah.
And education and academia and business, it all works the same way. So if I don't know anything about you, but you you trained at the Mayo Clinic and you're a doctor, like I should believe that you have some idea what you're talking about versus somebody from Hollywood upstairs medical college. That's legit. That's why it matters, and I think that's why people are incensed.
Sure, that's legit in many cases, but the opposite is also legit. For example, Casilda, my wife, trained as a physician in Portugal and then spent 7 years in Mozambique working in the bush. She was the only doctor going from village to village in a pickup truck with a bunch of surgical supplies and first aid stuff in the back of the truck. Now, if I had to go to a doctor, I would rather go to a doctor who spent 7 years driving from village to village in the bush and has no academic reputation. Of course, has an MD and has medical training, than someone who went to Johns Hopkins and knows how to use the MRI machine really well. So, I'm not saying that your point isn't legitimate, but I'm saying the opposite is also legitimate. Sometimes, to bring it into this case, I don't think it would have been possible to write this sort of critique of evolutionary psychology if I had gone to Austin and studied under David Buss, because my critique would have been undermining his career. So if I had gone, and that's probably the premier evolutionary psychology program in the country, or with David Simons or something when he was still at Santa Cruz.
You mean Don Simon?
Don Simon, yeah. The way academia works is you go and study under someone and you support their paradigm. And your PhD work generally supports the paradigm. That's why you went there in the first place.
And you are challenging a significant paradigm.
Yeah.
That's one of the issues here.
Well, it's funny because some people get really offended because we're challenging the paradigm. And then other people say, well, it's obvious. You're saying humans aren't monogamous. Well, of course we're not. It's a funny kind of dichotomy there.
Well, when we come back from the break, I absolutely want to talk about monogamy and the bullshit that I think that it is. And we'll look up the critique and we'll pull out some pieces and we'll talk piece by piece on that. But we'll be right back after this. You're listening to Ardent Atheist at ardentatheist.com and available at the iTunes Store. More after this unavoidable interruption.
We've had a lot of people ask us about the comedy sketch clips that we play from the Vile comedy album, Chaos Radio, so we are making it available to you. You can buy your favorite tracks from the 23-track record individually for $1, or you can buy the entire recording for $18. Go to gumroad.com/Emery. That's G-U-M as in man-eater.
What?
ROAD.com/Emery and buy the stupid thing.
Call me. Watermelons are a popular gift to bring to your host in China. I didn't know there were black people in China.
I'm going
to
kill you.
You wrote the punchline.
Yes, so I would have an excuse to kill you.
God, Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. we don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Hi, I'm David Diskin, and I wanted to tell you about Camp Quest West. We're a secular summer camp for non-religious families, and our week-long program for kids runs this summer in locations in California and over a dozen others throughout the U.S. At Camp Quest, we give kids the traditional camp experience, like archery, swimming, arts and crafts, and campfire songs, but we add science, skepticism, humanism, and critical thinking. There's a few spots left for parents who want to register their kids, but we're also asking for your help. We turn every donation into camperships for families that can't afford to send their children to camp. We're 100% volunteer-based, a tax-exempt 501c3, and our amazing financial aid program is supported by the free thought and skeptic community by people like you. I want to see how much Emery and Heather's fans can raise for Camp Quest West. Visit tinyurl.com/ardentcampquest or look for the link on their Facebook page. You can learn more about our California camps and the others throughout the U.S. by visiting campquest.org.
Did you see that UFO sighting that made the news? What did that latest study about alternative treatments really say? Is this photo making the rounds real or a hoax? Doubtful News is a unique website featuring news about pseudoscience, the paranormal, anomalies, and questionable claims framed with a skeptical view. Come visit DoubtfulNews.com every day for news about cryptozoology, conspiracies, shams, scams, and more. Follow us on Twitter at Doubtful News. Critical thinking is essential in assessing today's news. Doubtful News helps you decide, can you really believe this stuff?
And now back to Ardent Atheist Nonsense You Can Believe In. We're talking with Christopher Ryan and Ed Clint. We're talking about Sex at Dawn. Again, a book I'm really enjoying. Ed, we cut to break, and you had something that you wanted to respond to.
Oh, yeah. So you were saying before that you couldn't go and study under, you know, like David Buss or one of these programs because you would effectively be undermining that person's career. And I think that's not true, and it's also very unfair. It's implying many things about him or others.
Academia in general.
Yeah, right. I don't mean him specifically. Academia. Right. Keep it general.
Program you're talking about. So what Buss or people like him, myself, what we're trying to do is figure out things about humans, why they are the way they are, how they got to be how they are, you know, culturally and in other ways, right? So you come along and you say, I think you're wrong about this, this, and that. And in real academia, what happens is the person either says, no, you're wrong, and here's why, and they better have a damn good reason for why, or they say, oh my goodness, you're totally right. And that happens whether you're agreeing with them or not, whether you're undercutting what they have to say or not.
I disagree with that. It doesn't always happen as clean-cut as you just illustrated, Ed. In history, we've seen it many times, over and over again, when a particular paradigm is challenged, a major, major pushback happens. I mean, we see it every day. In fact, even Hawking. I was just watching a thing the other day about Hawking, some of his ideas being challenged. And when Hawking challenged ideas with his own ideas, there's a lot of pushback that has to play out.
But that's different. You're describing something that's very real and very much a problem in sociology of science, right? That's that two people of different interests having a collision and there being a difference in power and whoever's more powerful gets their way. What I'm talking about is what happens between like a thesis advisor and their grad student. This is not an antagonistic relationship. Or my colleagues at UCLA, we're not out to get each other. We're out to help each other. So when my colleague says, hey, that idea isn't very good, or it really needs improvement in this way, or you don't know about this study over here that completely undermines what you're talking about, they're doing that to help me, okay? There's not a I'm fighting you here kind of dynamic, so that's not what's happening.
Okay.
And that is what happens at a top-notch program at any university in this country, and I can tell you because I've either trained under them or I visited them, that really is how it works. So to say any evolutionary psychologist anywhere in the world will automatically kick you out for disagreeing is saying something horrible about a ton of people that you don't know and have never met. necessarily.
True. I have met David Buss and Helen Fisher, who I like a lot. We were talking about before, despite disagreeing with them. I wasn't trying to impugn anyone's integrity. What I was saying is that the way academia works, as far as I know, is that you go to study under someone in a graduate program with whom you agree, essentially. You don't go to a program where your the focus of your research is to undermine and subvert the paradigm that those people have spent their lives working on. That would be a very uncomfortable place to be for everybody.
Where you go to study is where your goals are the same. So if you want to, you're interested in a topic like sexuality or whatever, you go to where somebody's studying sexuality. If you're going to a place because you think that advisor will always agree with your paradigm and what you have to say, that's a horrible decision to make, and I don't think it's what people actually do. You certainly shouldn't. And by the way, I'm the contrary case that you're saying doesn't exist. Like 10, maybe a dozen years ago, I actually wrote a paper for a class community college, right? And it was an indictment of much of anthropology, in particular anthropology, because at the time I thought some of it was extremely objectionable. I didn't have a very nuanced opinion. I was lashing out against it. I'd read some pop science books, and I wrote papers just condemning the whole thing and explaining sociologically and politically what had gone wrong in the 20th century in anthropology. And today, I'm a grad student in an anthropology department trying to, among other things, make a positive contribution, add my critical voice to the work that other people are doing, because that's what everybody does. Mm-hmm. So you're saying that all this doesn't happen. I'm telling you, I'm living that happening, and you had that choice, and you decided to go a different way.
Okay, well, I found the article. It's a PDF. I found the article. What's the guy's name again? I keep forgetting it.
Talking about Ellsworth?
Yeah, Ellsworth. I found the Ellsworth thing. I'm going to jump right here. The standard narrative of male preference for youth and fidelity, contingency of parental investment on paternity certainty, female preferences for status, wealth, and willingness to invest, and the establishment of exclusive long-term reproductive bonds are seen by Ryan and Jetha not as elements of human nature so much as adaptation to social conditions, many of which were introduced with the advent of agriculture no more than 10,000 years ago, he cites page 8. Thus, monogamous pair bonding is a response to environmental novelty largely created by an agricultural mode of subsistence, and promiscuous, which we have to define promiscuous for us to discuss this, I think. It hits the wrong synapses when you just... I think you do that in the book, too.
We talk about why we ended up...
Impulses remain our biological baseline, our reference points. Page 46. Let's go to... and this is the part of the book, or the underlying idea in the book that really appeals to me a lot. I don't think that we're monogamous, by the way, by design. I don't think that we're wired to be monogamous. While I haven't worked this out completely, I'm going to try and give it to you now. My thoughts on the monogamous concept is that most people think of monogamous as life partnering. You know, nobody life partners in our society. It just doesn't happen. You start dating, you fuck. You don't fuck, you fuck, you don't fuck. You know what I mean? You get into a relationship, you plan to get married, you don't get married, then you finally do get married, then you divorce, then you fuck and you fuck and then you fuck some more, and then you find somebody that just is not going to take you fucking, and they say, all right, now we're going to fuck and only us are going to fuck. And that's not fucking monogamy, in my opinion, at all. Hmm. It's bullshit. In the poly world, I'm polyamorous, in the poly world, we refer to them as serial monogamists.
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
Monogamish.
I think the idea of monogamy is bullshit on its face. I think it's just absolute bunk.
What's the reason so many people are trying to be monogamous?
Because, in my opinion, thank you, church. Thank you, lie that is God. They're told that we're supposed to be pair bonding for life.
Except the ones that don't, like the Mormon Church or certain Muslim denominations, they don't, well, they don't specify
the
monogamy.
Women are supposed to be monogamous.
Yeah, yeah,
right. But that's not, that's still not monogamy.
Right, right. No one will disagree on this point. I guarantee you.
Did you get to the part in the book where we talk about penguins?
No, I haven't yet.
yeah.
Talk about the penguins.
Well, it's an example of what you're citing, right?
Yeah.
It's how these words get used and what is offered up as fact is actually propaganda. So we talk about the movie, the March of the Penguins, right? Mm-hmm. So that movie came out, I don't know what it was, 10 years ago or something, and it swept the nation. The churches were renting out cinemas and taking the whole congregation to see this movie because it was such a wonderful articulation of monogamy in nature, right? And, you know, they huddle in the storms and the males and the females take turns warming the egg while the other one trundles across the tundra to go fishing and then comes and vomits up the fish. And, you know, it's this great team, male-female teamwork monogamy. What they don't tell you is that those penguins are only monogamous for the breeding season.
They don't even say this.
No, they don't say that in the movie, right? And the next, and those, I think they're emperor penguins, and they live into their 30s. They're sexually matured about 14, 15. So they have about 20 sexual partners in their lives. And yet this movie is held up as a paragon of monogamy.
Mm. Right.
So, you know, it's an example of what you're saying. Like, well, what the hell are we talking about? What do we mean when we say marriage?
Yeah.
What do we mean when we say monogamy?
Right.
What do we mean when we say promiscuity? These are all very malleable words that, you know, we're throwing around as if we know what they mean. What do we mean when we say homosexuality?
Yeah.
There are tribes in the Amazon that believe that semen contains the essence of masculinity. So the teenage...
It doesn't?
Well, listen to the rest of this before you jump on that bandwagon. So the boys, young boys who want to be, grow up to be the, you know, most macho warriors and he-men, ingest as much semen as they possibly can, so they'll be more masculine.
Right
now, is that homosexuality? What's the word mean? You know, so a big part of the book
depends on how they're getting the semen. I got to be honest. That's where homosexuality is defined.
Yeah, well, you can guess how they're getting it. Right?
Well, I don't think it's. You can disagree, but I don't think it's appropriate to say, "Well, this is propaganda." Again, this is making a moral judgment on somebody on the basis of just disagreeing with their opinion. There are unique things about human beings, and one is our lifespan. And this comes from human behavioral ecology, not necessarily just evolutionary psychology, right? We live a long time. We are able to procreate at a similar time as chimpanzees, right? About a certain number, 15 or a little bit more than that years. But chimpanzees...
Seems to be moving backward.
It does, doesn't it?
I think scientifically they're saying that it is, too.
Yeah.
Am I wrong?
But you're right. In the evolutionary EEA,
right.
Late teens would have been the...
And a chimpanzee in the wild will die after 50-ish years, right? Or 40 to 50. I think it's closer to 40 and 50. It's for captivity, right? But humans, the natural lifespan seems to be around 70, even in pre-industrial societies, small-scale societies. And that's difficult to explain. Why do we have such a long lifespan? And the thinking here is that, well, we have a very complicated brain that takes a long time to develop and produce and to become an effective adult. So that requires a lot of investment that has to pay off. It also enables... you to invest in your offspring. It enables you to do things as a parent, a mother or a father, to help secure the success of your offspring and thereby increasing your fitness. So this is a mystery that needs an answer that has nothing to do with propaganda. That's an empirical question about why we have these features that we do. And so one of the answers is, well, if there's an opportunity for increasing my success by investing in various ways in my offspring, then and it takes a very long time and a lot of investment to produce an effective adult human, then I should be increasing my fitness by being a father. Now there's this thing called fatherhood, right? But attendant to that is the paternal uncertainty issue. So I am not increasing my fitness in the abstract theoretical sense, of course, if I'm raising somebody else's kid. So I have to have measures to try and reduce the possibility that I'm spending all of my resources raising a child that's not mine, And it also has to pay off more than me just catting around and finding other mates, which is another option that I have. So this is some of the logic. This is not people getting together and saying, I know what we'll do. we'll support the status quo however we can. It's real scientific questions and people earnestly trying to find answers to them.
Well, I really feel like that's what you're trying to do too. And I really feel like that that you make compelling arguments in the book. What's the lifespan of a bonobo? Is it the same as a chimp?
It's about the same as a chimp.
About
yeah.
the same.
Yeah.
And I almost when you start talking about you know the investment spending you putting your resources toward raising others children and all of that. That's why we need people like Ed to study this shit, because it, to me it's just so fucking, it becomes so beyond confusing once you get two or three layers into the variables. You know what I mean? It's bizarre how to me how anybody can even make any sense of it. Honestly, I'm just being honest. But when it comes to the status quo, if you will, the paradigm that we've all been told, basically that we're, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, because I am a lay idiot on some of this, the chimpanzee model is a really good example of why we are how we are. That's the basics, right? Is that the fundamentals?
Well, what happens is the chimpanzee is often held up as our closest primate relative, and the bonobo goes unmentioned.
Yeah.
And I find that to be, I'm sorry, I hope this won't offend you, but I do find that to be propagandistic. Because the fact is that in terms of DNA, last common ancestor, any scientific measure you want to use, we're equidistant to chimps and bonobos. Their line split off from the line that resulted in humans around 5 to 6 million years ago. And then their line separated about a million years ago, it's thought, into chimps and bonobos. So that's like I've got twin brothers. One's a chimp, one's a bonobo. They're very closely related to each other, but after the other, I'm their next closest relative,
okay.
Right? One of my twin brothers is aggressive, warlike, rape, infanticide, all that. That's the chimp.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one they always mention. They right. don't mention my brother who's working and with Mother Teresa or whatever. Bad example. but who's, you know, building houses with Jimmy Carter or whatever and has right. never hurt anyone and is beloved. And no bonobo has ever been seen in captivity or the wild to murder another bonobo, infanticide, or rape. That's significant.
They've and never been seen.
Never been seen.
So they're better at it.
And they've been studied since
they get
the
away
70s.
With it without getting caught. That's what you're saying.
Well, I don't think it's
never
it's
been witnessed. Well, if you don't, for example, Steven Pinker argues a lot about the primate origins of violence and warfare and all that. And if you're only talking about the chimp and you're not mentioning that there's another equally valid example, equally relevant to human development, that is completely the counterexample, then I think that's bad science.
No, it's not a counterexample. Example though, let me just say, like, the reason that you hear about the chimps is because they've just been studied more for reasons that have nothing to do with conspiracies. Just they were more interesting to people. I think they're more numerous.
Well, I don't think the conspiracy was to ignore the bonobo. I think it was right. just an error in data gathering.
It's actually,
isn't it?
Or
am I wrong?
The bonobos are embarrassing. Friends of all tells this great story.
Oh, my God. I've seen him speak, by the way. He spoke at USC.
Fantastic.
I went and watched him. Yeah.
So he tells this story about how he was hired by, I think it was ABC or you know, Nat Geo or one of these companies to consult.
Some letters hired him.
Right. On they wanted to do a thing on the bonobo. And so they sent a camera crew to Congo, where bonobos live. And they went to the sanctuary, and the bonobos were just, like, having sex, right? All this, and the camera crew was like, well, why are they doing this? And he said, well, that's what they do. And they like, we can't film this. We can't show this on American television. Are you kidding?
Only three strokes are allowed on network television. Then you have to cut to something else.
Really?
Yeah, that's what they do.
So I'm not saying it's a conspiracy in the sense that, you know, academics are getting together and saying, let's hide this data. But I am saying we live in a very sex-negative culture where people get embarrassed and freaked out and offended. And if you talk about a close primate relative of humans that, you know, resolves conflict. Franz de Waal said the chimp gets sex through violence, and bonobos avoid violence through sex.
That's nice. Mm.
So it's not a conspiracy, right. But it's not an accident either.
Right, but like there's an implicit point that you're making, and that's that people want to say that chimpanzees are our closest relative. Therefore, what they do is extra salient to what we do or what we are, and that's not true. In fact, the expression "our closest living relative on Earth," that doesn't mean anything. If all the primates but us died, then our closest living relative would be like a shrew or something, right? It's that wouldn't mean anything. And if more species died out, our closest living relative could be a fish. That doesn't really mean anything in itself. When people are studying chimps and trying to say this is meaningful about humans, they're saying in a given ecology, a primate might respond this way for fitness reasons that we can investigate, and that there might be an analog that in humans, or there might not be. But there has to be the ecology taken into account. There has to be the history taken into account. And people that I know that study these things, I know a few primatologists, that is what they do. And so that has to be, you know, stated. They're not just saying they're like us, therefore generalizations can be made about their behavior to humans.
Do you think, Ed, do you think that we human beings, do you think that we're wired, genetically wired to be monogamous? Do you think we're genetically wired to be in long-term marriages? And do you think that the studies of chimps helps support that view? Because that's my question. Do you think that's accurate?
No, I would not say that. I don't think anybody would say such a thing as humans are wired to be monogamous. What they will say is we are wired to have flexible strategies to deal with a multitude of situations that we would predictably find ourselves in over a long period of time. So it could be that you have an opportunity to invest in your offspring, or you might not. You might live in a society with alloparenting where everybody's kind of parenting everybody and that there isn't wealth for one reason or another. Maybe you're a nomadic tribe, and then your investment is relatively low. And so you're not going to get a strong tendency towards monogamy, for example. So, but there are a few different strategies that we would reliably expect to develop. So if there is an opportunity for provisioning your offspring, then we would expect that would be taken advantage of in some way. That's not the only kind of situation that we would anticipate or that evolution, if you will, would anticipate humans being in. And that's why we see a wide variety of mating systems across the human culture diaspora.
I would agree with that, that the mating system corresponds to ecological and economic conditions. The argument we make in Sex at Dawn is that before the advent of agriculture, virtually everyone was living in what Christopher Bohm and others have called fiercely egalitarian hunter-gatherer bands. So the underlying premise of this provisioning model at the heart of evolutionary psychology is that the man goes out and hunts and comes home and shares his meat primarily with his woman or wife or partner or whatever and their children that he knows to be his children so that his inclusive fitness is increased and all that business. The problem with that is that in these observed societies, what we find is that the most central organizing principle of those societies is sharing. And the worst thing that you can do is to hoard food or to direct the food unfairly to your preferred people. So to me, that completely undercuts one of the central assumptions of this evolutionary psychology reasoning, which is that men could not divert resources to their own children in fiercely egalitarian hunter-gatherer bands.
That's not true. It's I'll give you several reasons. One is there was a paper by Eric Alden Smith.
You're going to hate me. Can you give those reasons after the break?
All right.
I got to take a break. We're 10 minutes over for the break. I'm really sorry. As soon as we're back, all right, Ed? I want to hear it. You're listening to Ardent Atheist at ardentatheist.com and available at the iTunes Store. More after this insufferable disruption.
And now a special announcement. This is a big super shout-out to a few of our listeners. Matthew Cravat. Herbie Reagan, Mark Nowitzki, Adun, Stockin' Dawkins, who? Cunt is pie, not cake.
What?
Carl Barrett. I don't know.
Read that one.
Thundercock. Danielle Lucas, Finn Nicholas, Steve Hill, and Bah Drescher. That's Barbara.
Bah.
Cameron Winters and Joe Swam. These were some of the people chatting in the Wall of Reason last week. Thanks for being there, everybody.
Watermelons can cost up to $100 in Japan.
Are you going to do another black joke?
No, you didn't write one.
Exactly.
I wonder how much chicken is.
Don't.
Foundation Beyond Belief is a community of compassionate humanists and atheists supporting outstanding charities worldwide. Members sign up for automatic donations starting at $5 a month, then distribute those funds however they wish among the featured charities. To date, this unique humanist organization has raised over $750,000 to make this world a better, more humane place. We don't look to the skies for a better world. Foundation Beyond Belief is humanity at work. Learn more or join us at foundationbeyondbelief.org.
Hi, I'm David Diskin, and I wanted to tell you about Camp Quest West. We're a secular summer camp for non-religious families, and our week-long program for kids runs this summer in locations in California and over a dozen others throughout the U.S. At Camp Quest, we give kids the traditional camp experience like archery, swimming, arts and crafts, and campfire songs, but we add science, skepticism, humanism, and critical thinking. There's a few spots left for parents who want to register their kids, but we're also asking for your help. We turn every donation into camperships for families that can't afford to send their children to camp. We're 100% volunteer-based, a tax-exempt 501c3, and our amazing financial aid program is supported by the free thought and skeptic community by people like you. I want to see how much Emery and Heather's fans can raise for Camp Quest West. Visit tinyurl.com/ardentcampquest. Or look for the link on their Facebook page. You can learn more about our California camps and the others throughout the U.S. by visiting campquest.org.
Did you see that UFO sighting that made the news? What did that latest study about alternative treatments really say? Is this photo making the rounds real or a hoax? Doubtful News is a unique website featuring news about pseudoscience, the paranormal, anomalies, and questionable claims framed with a skeptical view. Come visit DoubtfulNews.com every day for news about cryptozoology, conspiracies, shams, scams, and more. Follow us on Twitter at Doubtful News. Critical thinking is essential in assessing today's news. Doubtful News helps you decide, can you really believe this stuff?
And now back to ardent atheist nonsense you can believe in. We're talking with Christopher Ryan and Ed Clint. You were about to make a point, and we had to go to break, Ed.
Yes, thank you. Chris has just made a point about societies, pre-modern societies, being all fiercely egalitarian. I think that's not true. Just a couple of years ago, Eric Alden Smith et al. Reviewed a dozen societies, and they looked at they created a kind of Gini index for these societies, which is an estimate of disparity in wealth in that society. So there was a good range in these, but none of them was zero. The lowest was like 0.07, I think. One had higher wealth disparity than the United States. So these are all hunter-gatherer societies. So there's a good amount of variation. Now, I should say, the way that they measured that is things like embodied capital, relationship benefits, and that kind of thing. So we're not material wealth is only one kind of measure in that society, but there's definitely privileged roles going on. So that's just not true that it was always egalitarian. And plus, you have another problem of the ubiquity of sexual jealousy. So, for example, among the Himba of Namibia, my colleague at UCLA here, Brooke Shelza, just published a paper on sexual jealousy in that culture. And in that culture, there's marriage. Between one or two or more wives, that's not uncommon. As is divorce, but they're not completely monogamous. In fact, cheating or having lovers on the side is acceptable. It's socially acceptable. It's known. It's not a big, it's not a huge taboo. But at the same time, they looked and found that those people were upset at the idea of their lover having sex with somebody else or falling in love with somebody else.
So there were jealousies even though it was an accepted practice.
Mm. There's jealousies even though it's completely accepted practice. And that ubiquitous sexual jealousy is very hard to explain across cultures if you think that monogamy is a recent invention.
Well, all right, Chris, let's talk about monogamy versus shared partners versus, and we're not talking about polygamy. To be, if you're a listener that you and you don't, most of my listeners know what we're talking about. But just to be clear, polygamy is awful. Polygamy is treating women like cattle. It's fucking awful, and it's what some religions. In Western culture has done in the past, and some are still doing it. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, and I really like the poly option for this reason, because it equalizes the genders. It gives everybody the same value, I was personally wired to be polyamorous. It was always something that I was working toward, moving toward, you know, I've never been accepted, even in the community of skepticism and atheism. There are people who whisper behind my back, "I'm an out of the closet bisexual polyamorous guy."
Especially our neighbors.
Our neighbors hate us. And just the other day, I was in a Starbucks with a girl who lives somewhere on my street that waits on us there, and she doesn't know that I'm polyamorous. As far as I know, she doesn't know this. I presume she doesn't. And just, I think it was yesterday or today, she goes, "Oh, I met someone else from our street." And I said, "Who did you meet?" "Yeah, it was a guy that that lives down a couple blocks down from where I am." She's always excited that we live on the same street. I think it's hilarious. And I go, "Yeah," I go, "I don't know a lot of people in my little corner of the neighborhood, because my neighbors are psycho bitches, and they're really, really awful people." The stories I could go on. I don't really hang out with people off our street much. And she goes, "Yeah," she goes, "I have some good neighbors." And then there's the guy across the street. I'm not kidding. I'm not making this up. This is what she said to me. She goes, "Yeah, the guy that lives across the street's really creepy. I think he's got more than one girlfriend." That's what she said. Yeah. And I kept my mouth shut. It's hard for me not to speak up to those kind of moments, but I didn't say anything to her. But
she's assuming that he's lying, right?
Yeah,
she's
that's what everyone assumes about me.
Right,
say
right.
What she said after that.
Help me.
And she said, "And that's wrong."
Oh, yeah, she said that's wrong. That's she goes, "Yeah, that's just wrong. Wrong. Yeah. That's just wrong." She said that. Yeah. And so what really excites me about your book, listen, whether the scientific arguments that you're making, and this is where I keep going every couple pages, I keep thinking, these scientific arguments to me, they really don't matter to the broader idea, in my opinion. They don't. They just don't matter. We are human beings. We can make whatever fucking choices we want, and we can be however we want to be. And I think what we should build toward is a society where true freedom, the gay rights discussion, shouldn't be about the science of it. It shouldn't be about whether or not it's natural or a choice. That is a complete fucking red herring. It's a pile of bullshit to argue from that perspective. The only argument for gay rights or human rights is freedom. Are we not free, sir? That's the only one. And when you say that to an asshole who says, "Well, what's next? We're going to let people marry animals?" Are we not free is the only thing you should be saying to these fucks. And that's how I feel we should live. Everybody should live however the fuck they want to live. And we definitely should do everything we can. I have a quarrel. And I feel like you might too, Chris. I have a quarrel with television and the way that it presents what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I've diatribed. I apologize.
Have you seen that commercial for Coca-Cola? No, Cheerios, I'm sorry, with the interracial couple and the small child that's mixed race?
Yeah.
And how people have been going nutso over the fact that Cheerios has a commercial with a black dad and a white mom,
which is just wrong. Just fucking wrong.
It was a Super
black
Bowl commercial.
Kids don't eat Cheerios. Sorry.
I agree with you. Not about the Cheerios, but about people should be able to live how they want to live, that they're not hurting anybody. But there is actually a bit of science that's relevant to that, and that's that there is such a thing as human nature, and part of that human nature is
bigotry.
People don't like to be treated unfairly. They don't like to be told how they are, they don't like to be forced to live a certain way by other people. So the desire for self-determination and autonomy, that is part of our makeup. That is part of our being. And that is evolutionary psychology as well.
Hmm. Of course, evolutionary psychology is just bunk. All you have to do is ask Rebecca Watson, and she'll explain it to you.
I don't want to even get started.
Yeah. Is that? Yeah, that's Wendy laughing. Chuckling over there. I feel, of course, we all go through our own filter. We come out of our own filter. I feel, as I look around at my friends, my family, everybody around me, I feel like we would be a much better society if we weren't obsessed with marriage and pair bonding. I really feel that. I feel that's true. And I have no problem with pair bonding.
How will they make money?
I mean, exclusionary pair bonding.
How will they make money at Christmas and Valentine's Day if we're not?
They'd make more.
You think?
Yes. Yes. If I have to buy a birthday card for all my girlfriends, it's more money being spent.
And three diamond rings?
Yes, exactly.
Hint.
Oh, shit.
I'm just kidding.
All right.
You know what? One thing that's relevant to the gay rights movement and what we're talking about tonight is that, you know, as you said, the only question should be, are we free, right? Another question is, what is sex for, right? The underlying assumption in a lot of these critiques of gay marriage, or at least the resistance to gay marriage, is that sex is about reproduction. Mm. And one of the central points that we make in the book is human sexuality is not primarily about reproduction.
No, it's not.
It's primarily about establishing bonds.
Right.
It's about intimacy. It's about connectivity between people. So what we argue is that human sexuality got co-opted, just much like bonobo sexuality, for social purposes. And reproduction's an infrequent byproduct of human sexuality.
Well, it needs to be less frequent, I got to be honest.
These days, yeah, definitely.
I agree with that. I don't think anybody would, in academia, would disagree with the point that sex is not just about reproduction. I mean, we're not estrous animals. We could be, or the animals that get pregnant every time they have sex, as rodents do. So we very much obviously have a very social, bonding, entertainment, you know, aspect of sex that is, I would say it's unlike other any other animals, including our closest relatives.
I don't know any other animals that have strippers on poles.
The only way to find out is put poles in the forest with the bonobos.
Bonobos and chimps would swing on the pole.
Maybe.
If you gave them a pole.
Without hesitation.
They'd be on it. And dolphins also are socially sexual. They have sex for non-reproductive reasons.
And they rape.
And, well, see, now rape's another one of those words, right? You know, orangutans are often said to rape. Rape's a very human concept. Mm.
No, I don't think it is a human concept. I mean, part of it is, but if you look at the genital tracts of ducks, for example, where they have an adaptation that lets them physiologically thwart an unwanted, attempt at copulation via the corkscrewing of the genitals, that's very much an adaptation for stopping a sexual act that animal prefers not to be happening. Well, so we're not talking about just humans.
You were headed somewhere. I want to hear it, Chris.
I got sidetracked.
I'm sorry.
The corkscrew duck penis threw me
right?
off there.
Pretty fucking cool.
Yeah.
Humans don't have that.
I mean, I guess what I was going to say is...
You said it's a very human construct.
Because we're assuming from what we observe in the behavior of the female that she is trying to resist this copulation. And yet when you look at a species like orangutans, where the vast majority of the copulations have those characteristics... And you say, well, okay, on the one hand, that looks like rape to us. But on the other hand, that's more or less normal orangutan sexual interaction. I mean, isn't rape by definition an exception to the rule? If it is the rule, then can we still call it rape? I mean, we're assuming we know what these animals are thinking. There's a lot of anthropomorphizing going on. Well,
how much wine is the male orangutan filling the female orangutan with? That's the question.
Chris, that's true of everything. All the bonobos research that you're talking about, that's true of all of that research. It's people watching behaviors and making inferences about them, including the ones that support your case. So you have to be careful in how you state this. I think this is... an objection to your research. And I'll pull an example from your book just because it's one that I actually happen to know. You quote people like Don Simons about the differences in the sexual behavior of men and women. And then the next thing you say is, so look, the evolutionary psychologists are saying women don't like casual sex. That's literally what you said. You said women, that we're saying that women don't like casual sex. Nobody says that or anything like that. In fact, the people that you are saying are such a problem, like David Buss, have said the opposite. David published a book about it, about why women have sex. And the top reasons, the reason he published his book is because the reasons are so fascinating and numerous, and because the top ones are similar for men and for women, things like for pleasure. So evolutionary psychologists have explicitly studied and said it is for pleasure, it is for these other things, and you write in your book, they're saying that that women aren't interested in casual sex.
But you said you haven't read the book.
That part I did read.
Right. Well, did you get that out of the PDF that we were pulling from earlier? Because he quotes it a couple times.
Because I think the section you're referring to is where we're critiquing the Clark and Hatfield study, the famous study in Florida, where undergrads went up to they found attractive men and women, and they gave them clipboards, and they told them to go walk up to strangers on campus and say, hi, I've seen you around school. I think you're
I saw
really
that
cute.
Study. Yeah.
You know, not correct that they were attractive men and women. The study doesn't mention...
It does, actually. It but says that they I mean,
were,
whatever.
That it didn't matter to the results and that they were moderate or to average. They weren't high attractive people. The original Hatfield and Clark study is what you're talking about, right?
Right. The point of the study, as I understood it, was that the men almost invariably said yes to the offer of casual
right,
sex,
right.
And the women all invariably said no.
Right.
And the conclusion that the researchers drew from this was that women were significantly less interested in casual sex than men. I think that's the section of the book that you're referring to. I don't think it was David Buss or Donald Simons. But and our critique is saying, well, that doesn't take into consideration the fact that you know, women have a lot of reason to be very suspicious of a stranger who walks up to them on campus and says, hey, I'd like to have casual sex with you.
Right.
If she knew the guy, if she was very comfortable with the guy, if the context were completely safe and she didn't have to worry about being slut-shamed afterwards and all these other things that...
When you remove those elements, the equation changes.
Right. And so we do look at societies in which those elements don't exist, in like the Mosuo of China, and we find that the women have just as many lovers as the men on average, and some hunter-gatherer societies that we cite as well.
That's why the book impresses me. I really do disagree with the negative critiques largely of what you're saying in the book. Again, I'm halfway through the book, so maybe I'll call
but
you
that,
when I'm
that
done and go, you're out of your fucking mind, Ryan!
But finding has been upheld in all the further research across the world. You can find variability across societies, but in general it has had very well in very many studies in very many countries.
And I'll tell you, I think one of the greatest mistakes that we're going to learn, eventually understand, that we've been making in science are these causal studies. I think they're really fucking flawed. I think I nearly every goddamn causal study I come across, I think that they're not, that they don't seem to be taken into consideration these other obvious elements, and they're drawing conclusions without considering them, like you just illustrated, Chris. And that's how I feel about most causal studies. In fact, when I come across one that seems, smells, looks, and reads as if they fucking thought of everything, I'm really excited. But that tends to be rare for me. You know what I'm saying? Okay, we're going to wrap up the free portion of the show. And we are not going to fight anymore for the premium version of the show.
They're not even naked.
Did you see the Ken Ham thing, Chris?
No.
We're going to talk a little about Ken Ham.
Yeah.
Did you see it,
I did not.
Ed? Really? Maybe we won't do Ken Ham, but we'll talk about 22 messages from creationists to people who believe in evolution. It's one of the funniest things I've read this year. I swear to fucking Christ, people are stupid. All right, here we go. This. Hold on. Sorry. Honey, I can't
That's
find it.
For
there it is. That's it for the free version of episode 143, another show that went off without a hitch. We miss you, Hitch. This show was filled with hitches. I'm your host, Emery Emery.
And I'm Heather Henderson.
Our theme music, courtesy of the sound editor of the Aristocrats, Eric Wilson, and special guest to our Wall of Reason moderator, Joseph, 7-Minute Workout Swam, and our digital publicist and web guru, Cameron, 3-Minute Jerkoff Winters.
Some characters mentioned in this podcast are completely fictitious. Any resemblance to real persons, living or dead, is purely wishful thinking.
Where can people find you, Chris?
ChrisRyanPhD.com. Follow me on Twitter at ChrisRyanPhD.
Nice. Where can they find you, sir?
SkepticInc.com.
Skeptic Inc. That's where you find Ed. You've been listening to Ardent Atheist. Ardent Atheist is a product of natural selection.